You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, November 10th, 2010. This is episode 157, Synapse. We are back with another edition of the Wells Tech Podcast, where technology intersects with ministry. My name is Martin Spriggs, and happy to have you all back and joining me, as usual, from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota, via the wonders of technology and Skype. Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. I don't know if we'd call Skype so wonderful this morning.
Not always.
Sometimes it gives us a little headache.
I had to go to Plan B today. My usual Skype account was not on its game, so we had to go to Plan B. But we're resourceful. We are technicians, so we find a way.
Amazing audio skills that you possess there.
It's nothing to do with my skills or even audio. you should always have, that's a good rule of thumb in technology, have a plan B and C.
Yeah, because it's going to fail no matter what you do.
There's too many, as they say, moving parts to not fail. So there's the connection, there's the software, there's user error.
That never happens.
What are you going to do? Right. And especially for people, this is probably a good lesson too, those of you that use technology either in the classroom or in, let's say, a worship service, it's always good to have a plan B.
That's right. Ours tends to fail on us about 2 minutes before worship's going to start. If it's going to fail, that's the time.
Uh-huh.
So we've had some real issues with DVD recorders, and it seems like the quality just isn't out there to get a good recorder that's going to be consistent for you and stuff. So we always try to start early and make sure everything's firing up as expected every Sunday morning when we want to make our recordings. So.
And you're doing that for shut-ins and other uses?
Actually, we distribute to three different television stations in the area. So we have three that we record at the same time, if all goes as planned.
Mm-hmm. So. Now, our congregation uses a DVD recorder as well, and we've never had an issue. It's been working
maybe
flawlessly.
Maybe we need to talk about that on the podcast.
And I don't think it was a high-quality thing, but we haven't had any issues. We're trying to get that, you know, onto a more usable format on the computer so that we can upload it more easily rather than ripping it and, you know, manipulating it after the fact from a DVD. But that's a whole nother story. Anyway, that's not what we're supposed to be talking about, Sally. We are talking about your book.
Leading 21st Century Schools. We are on chapter 3 of the book, and I don't think I can claim it as my book anymore because somebody did a presentation and used a lot of material from this book.
I did. I thought it was real useful for, I don't remember what presentation it was even at this point, but we're kind of getting into the meat of the book at this point. We'd spent a couple weeks now on chapters 1 and 2, a little more theoretical, talking about, you know, the distinction between digital immigrants and digital natives, talking about standards. Now we begin to talk about some tools.
That's right. And Lynn and Barbara start off this chapter just kind of talking about what exactly Web 2.0 is and why it's important for us to begin to think in terms of Web 2.0. Now, I know that's a term we toss around real frequently here on the podcast, Martin, but it was good for me to go back and kind of look back at Web 1.0 and contrast that to Web 2.0. And she does a good job of that, or they do a good job of that, at the beginning of this chapter 3.
Yeah, there is a chart, a handy little chart there talking about Web 1.0 versus Web 2.0. And just to quickly go down, Web 1.0 is characterized by they use the term application-based, isolated, offline, licensed or purchased, single creator, proprietary code, copyrighted content. And then when you move into the Web 2.0 world, purely web-based, collaborative, online, free, multiple users, open source, and shared content. So that's quite the journey in just a few years, where we came from an online environment that was very one-directional to something that is, there probably isn't an app created today that doesn't have some kind of collaborative or dynamic nature to it.
That's right. And I think that dynamic, you know, they had this platform and they could make it user created, allowing people to log in and update content on the web on the fly, and it be readily available to everyone who views that particular website or web page. Mm-hmm. And that's just a huge threshold that they crossed. The technology was there, but then they began to use it and be creative with it and came up with this whole Web 2.0 world that we're living in now. And what that does is it puts the power of creation in each individual's hands. You know, I think we talked about that a long time ago when we talked about Here Comes Everybody, the book that we reviewed quite a while ago by Clay Shirky, and that that power to create is there. And in this book, then we're looking at taking that power to create and giving it to students and allowing them to use these Web 2.0 tools to do the work that they do in school and to learn from and begin to use it for all that they do in life.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I picked up on in reading the first few chapters or the first few pages of this chapter was one of the key benefits to this kind of new world order, this Web 2.0 world, is the ability to give access to the educational process to parents so that they can kind of take a peek and even get involved if they like with what their kids are doing. And I think that's a win-win. You know, the old days, you know, that was harder to do, where a child would come home with work and the parent could review it at that point. But here, as stuff goes online and if done appropriately, parents can get involved in the process within the process, as opposed to, you know, at the end of the whole thing.
And I think a key component to that is being able to communicate on a regular basis with your parents and to teach them to look for these things online. And so as you're building these programs, teachers, you need to build in parent communication into the process so that every week or whatever, when you have a chance, you're updating them via a newsletter or whatever and teaching them, coaxing them to regularly go and look at the work that's available online and the tools that are available there.
Mm-hmm. So let's maybe look at a few of the tools. We can't go through all the tools that are mentioned in this chapter, but there are probably three or four that are really key to perhaps a teacher wanting to begin to use some of the Web 2.0 tools that are out there. One of them that comes across real clear in this chapter and elsewhere in the book are wikis. And probably the premier wiki tool that's out there for teachers is Wiki Spaces.
That's right. And I think Gail in the past especially has shared a lot of Wiki Spaces pages that she's used with her students. So I know, you know, we have some examples from within Wells in the book. Lynn and Barbara give us several examples that you can reference as well to see what wikis can do for a classroom. The big deal with wikis is collaboration, group projects, and how many teachers, you know, assign kids to group projects. It's a very common thing. And this, she even contrasts in the book that the kids started with trying to make connections and do their group project in a paper kind of method, and then they transitioned to the online wiki method, and what a breakthrough it was for them to be able to collaborate online in that way. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, one of the benefits is that these Web 2.0 tools are accessible from any computer, so they can take this, you know, home with them very easily and still be collaborating from home during homework time or whatever.
And as I said later in the book, they go into a little bit more detail. One of the more intriguing ideas that I read about was a group of students actually rewriting a textbook in a wiki. So they're basically taking core material of a subject matter and in their own words, rewriting the textbook. What a great learning experience that would be, in doing it all within a wiki, which is essentially a web page that people can edit, and that's got many uses that I think we'll talk about later as we go through the rest of the book.
And, you know, Martin, just mentioning that, just a side note, for teachers or any kind of church committee or whatever, if you're working on any kind of shared document, it's a great example, a great place to do that. I know here in Sleepy Eye, it made the local newspaper that our public school system did their curriculum planning in a wiki. Mm-hmm. And then they made that all public for everyone to be able to see and review the modifications they had done to their curriculum planning. So lots of planning and collaboration can go on there.
Mm-hmm. One of the other tools which we've talked about a lot and I think is becoming mainstream in some classrooms are blogs, and probably the premier educational focused blogging engine right now is Edublogs, which I've just played around a little bit with in prep for some of the classes or workshops I was leading, and boy, is it really easy to set those up. You're up in about 2 minutes. Edublog is based on WordPress, which we've also talked about in the past, so very full-featured but very easy to use.
And another one that's actually gotten some attention lately is KidBlog. And also, it is based on WordPress. And again, very quick and easy to get up and and going with that. You have a moderator, a teacher account, and all the kids can have their own logins and things. You can make it completely private.
Was that the one you did, or did you do Edublogs? You did one for your classroom, right?
Right. We use KidBlog, which is newer than this book. So she doesn't mention it specifically in the book. But both of those are excellent blogging platforms for students.
Okay.
Very secure.
Right. And then two others that we'll touch on briefly is one of the big categories, which I'm kind of excited about, is bookmarking, which she calls education, or the authors call educational bookmarking. We've talked about Delicious in the past. One that they reference here is Backflip. This kind of has an interesting story behind it, Sally, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was kind of funny. Both of us said, gee, I never heard of Backflip. So we went to check it out since they had chosen to mention it in the book. And when we did, we found, sadly, that Backflip no longer exists. And not only does it not exist, but they have a really sad goodbye notice on their website.
Let me read this. This is on their blog. Or when you go to backflip.com, you can read this too. Back on November 1st. As everyone has figured out by now, it would take an unbelievable optimist at this point. Backflip will not be returning in its previous form. The data was irrevocably lost. It's truly painful to admit defeat, but it's been over a year, and the motivation just isn't there to continue further. We have exhausted almost every attempt at recovery, but have succumbed to a most unfortunate series of events governed by Murphy's Law. Massive power spikes wiped out our database servers over a year ago. Our backups were missing a critical file due to human error. Children have been born and priorities changed. And so after almost exactly a decade online, the current incarnation of Backflip is no more. Thank you to everyone who supported us through the many years. Thank you to all the wonderful donations, blah, blah, blah. quite the plight. And again, probably reemphasizes a caution that should be observed when dealing with Web 2.0, and that's make sure that you're dealing with a solid company, and you need to do your homework, and you may want to anticipate the worst, because this can happen, and companies go in and out of business like this. So, great lesson learned, and a very humorous demise, I guess. Maybe not humorous to them, but humorous to us.
Yeah, I'm guessing not.
Nice life lesson.
Yeah. And, you know, perfect to go along with this chapter of the book. As we start talking about the wonders of Web 2.0, there can be a downside. And so, you know, be careful what you put out there. If you don't have it backed up yourself, you know, make sure you're putting it in a safe place.
Mm-hmm. Little tool out there that I found helpful. I don't know that we've ever brought this up on the show before. Maybe we have. Called Backupify. It works with different services like your Gmail and Google Docs and Facebook, and interfaces with those accounts and does a backup. So it's really backing up the web. It's a free tool, and just gives you a month or a weekly, I think, accounting of what it backed up, and allows you to get that stuff if something bad were to happen to those services.
Sounds like a good idea.
It is.
And last on our list of Web 2.0 tools that we wanted to mention from this chapter is Google Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And Google Earth is one that I just really haven't tackled as a technology teacher. I don't know if I'm a little intimidated by the learning curve or something, but I found an mm-hmm. interesting blog post from Rob Jacklin, who mm-hmm. I believe is a Missouri Synod school teacher. And he talks about using Google Earth with his fifth and sixth graders. And it's funny because he started out this school year real enthusiastic about some geography lesson plans that he had for the students to use Google Earth. And then he encountered some challenges with it. And he kind of talks about that in the blog post. But alas, he's convinced that Google Earth is a great teaching tool, and he's not blaming it. He's just going to keep persevering and get the students on board with what he's trying to accomplish there. So perhaps he can be some inspiration to you. He's a blogger, and his blog is called Technology in the Lutheran Classroom. We'll have a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, and if you are a teacher that uses Google Earth, and I know you are out there, give us a shout. Let us know how you're using it, and maybe share lesson plans and your experiences with Google Earth. It is it's an amazing and incredible tool. Did we talk about it a couple weeks ago in the context of getting all of our congregations in locator search on in a GPS format? Maybe we didn't even mention
that.
Yeah,
I think that is one of the options that's available.
You can
download the
KML file, right? And I downloaded that to my Google Earth, and I could zoom across the country and see all of our Wells congregations because we've got that GPS locator working now. So very good. Good conversation, I think, in this chapter. Good introduction to Web 2.0 tools, and then the rest of the book really dives in a little bit deeper with some awesome examples of using some of these tools in the classroom. So it gets very practical at that point. So
looking forward to more.
All right. We should probably get on to our interview today, Sally. And this is Carol Lightnin, who we both kind of ran across within the space of a couple weeks. And you ran across her at the Minnesota State Teachers Convention, and mm-hmm. I at the Wisconsin State Teachers Convention. She was there with a game that she has been creating, as you'll hear in the interview, called Synapse.
Yeah, I enjoyed talking with Carol and hearing the history, a little bit about how she developed the game and brought it to market, and also developed the iTunes app as well. So mm-hmm. let's take a listen to that conversation with Carol.
Joining us today on the Wells Tech Podcast is Carol Lightnin from New Ulm, Minnesota. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. Good to have you. Thanks for doing this. We ran across you in a couple locations. Both Sally and I think, were interested in what you have there with a new game. The reason that we're interested is because obviously there's a technology component. It's not just a board game, but it's got some legs in the technology world, and we thought, boy, it would be great to have you on to talk about it, and we were both interested in it. In fact, I showed it to my wife, and she downloaded the app right to her iPhone right away and started playing with it. She's a literature teacher and is really thinking of ways to use it already. So maybe we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but before we go into the kind of description of the game that we're talking about, tell us a little bit about yourself, what congregation you're a member of, family, work, hobbies, that kind of stuff, just the Reader's Digest version of Carol Lightnin.
Okay. Well, I actually grew up in New Ulm, went to MLC, graduated, and emergency taught 1 year, and then taught 4 years in St. John's Lyonon.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband is Wayne. I met him my second year of teaching. He was a seminary student.
Mm-hmm.
And we were married for my last year of full-time teaching, and then he took his assignment was to Ohio. We had three children there. Mm-hmm. Jeremy is our oldest, and he is now a pastor in Benton Harbor, married to Abby, and Becky is our next child, and she and her husband Ben have just started the ministry that they will be doing as long as God wants them, mm-hmm. I guess, as it works out in Russia.
Oh,
and
wow.
And our son Dan and his wife are in Wichita. Hannah is her name. They are in Wichita where he is vicaring this year.
Okay.
And our youngest daughter is just starting college in St. Paul, Minnesota. She's the first one who didn't go to MLC.
Now that you're in New Ulm, you don't have anybody in MLC.
Right. Right. I never expected to get back to my home congregation. We were in Toledo. We were in Palos Heights, which is near Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we were in Oklahoma for 9 years. And then my husband was called back to my home church, which was a real different situation. But it's worked out very well.
And you're at St. Paul's or St. John's?
St. John's.
St. John's. Okay.
Right.
In New Ulm. Okay. Very good. So maybe we can start a little bit with the history of this game that you've called Synapse. Maybe where it all started, where the idea came from, and then kind of walk us through the development of this cool little game.
Okay. Well, it started off probably 15 or so years ago when my sister brought an idea for a game around the campfire. I'd call it a parlor-type game. It really didn't have rules or even a name. But the idea of building a set where each member of the team adds one word, and the guesser on the team has to guess what word they are trying to describe by everybody else working together. And we just played it around the campfire at Camp Cry when we were after we put our children to bed. The adults did this. And I really liked the concept of it. And so I kind of wrote down a quick description and I tucked it away in my game file because I have always enjoyed getting a group of people together playing different games and laughing and having fun together.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just was one that I would pull out at various times over the years, like with church groups, like Lutheran Girl Pioneers, or if we'd have friends over, and we didn't play it a lot, but it was just there in my file.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2003, on New Year's Day, we had some friends over, and we played some different games, and we ended the evening with what I think I called them the sentence game. And they played it more like Password, and it really flopped, and I was kind of disappointed that it wasn't as fun and as funny as it should be. And the next night, I had my parents, our youngest daughter, was home with us, and I invited a friend over. The other three children were actually in Germany at the time. But anyway, after supper, we played Sequence. And whenever we play Sequence, we'll usually tell the person who doesn't know that, which was my friend at that time, that my older sister, Kathy, and her husband, Jim, knew the inventor of Sequence. And we just talked a little bit about that. Then when we were done playing Sequence, I said, would you like to try a game that really flopped last night? And they said, sure. And I told them, you know, that we have to build sentences. We can't just throw out words like password. And it was a paper and pencil game that we just wrote a word down on a little slip of paper. And everybody enjoyed it a lot. They liked it enough that they wanted to play several rounds, which we did. And then when we were done, this friend of mine, Anita, said, you should try to market this the way Doug did with Sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how the idea was put into my head.
Very good. So that was 2003, and here we are in 2010. A few years have passed. I'm guessing it took a little bit of time to develop it into the professional game that you're now selling.
Right. Well, I contacted my sister, and she gave me the contact information to Doug. I emailed him, and he called me right back and talked to me for about 45 minutes. And his best piece of advice to me was to field test it as much as you can to get all the kinks out. So I had two children at MLC, one in high school, one in grade school. And I used all of their friends to come over lots of times and serve them treats and pizza or whatever, and we just kept playing it and playing it. And I was encouraged to continue because they all loved it and really gave me the idea that maybe this would work. So then I realized that I had to get standardized words. I couldn't just have people write their own words because that was very uneven in play. And I started developing the different categories, and they would just pop into my head at different times. It's really interesting how the creative process works. For example, one idea, the rhyming words, popped into my head when we were traveling with our youngest daughter, Anna, to go visit our son at Luther Prep at the time. And she and I were trying a bunch of them with Wayne, who was driving. She and I would build the sentences, and we were just laughing and having a good time. So that's how I got that one added. And then the cross currents category, which is alliteration, two words that start with the same sound. That idea popped into my head when I was swimming one time. And then the original idea of writing your own words is actually the category that's called creative impulse now. So people could still do what was the original game. But I found that after they've played the standard, the brain chain, or word link, I should say, word link, brain chain, and cross currents, they get a better idea of what kind of words to write down for their own words. And then the harder words are always fun to do in that category. It's called surge. And it all was just a process that developed over time. I really didn't have a big master plan to how this was going to work. And then when I was field testing it, I realized that we had to have different rules. And I came up, I didn't know how much time should be allowed, but I came up that a minute is a pretty good time. And just different things like that that developed. I also threw out hundreds, if not thousands, of words. I would just work on these lists to find words that would be suitable for building a sentence to describe. And do you want me to just keep talking? Sometimes I go on and on.
I can tell you're excited about it. So at some point, you've created the board game. So there's actually a boxed, and I saw it at State Teachers Conference. It's a rectangular box, you know, like any other board game. And then in that box is what?
There's a timer. And the timer was the big problem for me because it was easy enough for me to write all the words on different colored pieces of paper, and I had different categories. That was easy. And I found a company actually in Michigan that I thought that I could self-produce it with. And actually, before that happened, I had tried contacting different game companies, and I learned pretty quickly that they all have their own game developers or designers, and they didn't know me from anybody, and it was just no use. I would have to get an agent. I didn't want to pay an agent. I just felt very unsure about all of that. And so I did a lot of research on the internet at that time. And one website really helped me, and it talked about the percentage. It's like 3%, I think, of people can actually get their ideas produced with a game company. But they said, if you think you have a really good idea, try to do it yourself, because you will be most successful if you do it that way. Because if you get an agent or just submit your game to a game company, they probably won't be interested in it. And so I would talk to different people about it, and they all encouraged me to do it. But the timer was the problem. I knew that this little kitchen timer that we were using just was not something that would be catch people's attention. And so what happened is, again, with the field testing, my daughter Jeremy's girlfriend at the time, now his wife, suggested that I talk to her uncle Paul Wessel. He's the brother of Keith Wessel, who's an MLC professor, and the son of Howard Wessel, who was actually one of my professors. And he had developed a product called GlucoBoy. So he was the one then who introduced me to a product design company in Chanhassen, Minnesota. And we played the game with them, and they were very enthusiastic about it. And so that really lit a fire under me, and they were real eager to work with me with it. However, they work with all kinds of big-name companies, and they didn't buy my idea. People think that companies will buy their ideas, but mm-hmm. they don't. Mm-hmm. But they helped me, and we got a product that looked pretty good, and I found out what it is like to bring a product to market. You have to work out every tiny little detail with them. And but I loved it. It was so different from anything else in my life. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't as, my time wasn't as much taken up with being a choir director and an organist, because I had always been that in our three former congregations. But I did play organ for a little while, and we have plenty of music professors from the college who are mm-hmm. choir directors. So with only one child really home full time and just teaching piano lessons, I had the time to work on it, and it just was fun for me. And I always thought as I was working on it, of I think there was an adage like, find the job that you like to do and it won't seem like work.
Right. Where'd the name come from? How did you come up with the name?
The name actually was Wayne's idea. I had a notebook, which I started jotting all my ideas down, and the first thing I put down was Carol's Game, suggestions for a name, and I had a whole list of different ones. And one of the names was actually Chain Reaction, and that ended up being, this was long before the TV show was on. Do you know the TV game mm-hmm. show Chain Reaction? Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was one of the ideas. I had a whole list of different ones. One of them, I think, was Word Link, the Sentence Game, different things like that. And then I would ask people, and finally the idea of synapse kind of settled in, because a synapse is a connection between neurons, and the messages are passed all around our bodies uh-huh. with the neurons going to the brain, and they have to jump the gap, which is called the synapse between two neurons. And that's kind of like when you play the game, you have to make a connection from person to person, and it has to kind of jump the gap, mm-hmm. that space between people, okay. so that it all works together to make sense.
Sure. So how do you...
And then the tagline under it, Teamwork at the Speed of Laughter, was a contribution of our son, Dan, and... he asked me one time when I was struggling with a tagline, and he said, well, what do you want to get across with it? And I said, well, laughter and teamwork and that it's fun. And he just strung those words together and came up with a winning tagline. As you could see, it was kind of a family project.
For sure.
I put the most time into it that everybody would contribute.
That's fun. That sounds like a lot of fun to go through the whole process. So Sally and I both saw you with a display at a teacher's conference. Have you seen this in use, or have you heard stories about how teachers might be using this in a classroom setting?
Yes, I actually was the one that started it, and I was field testing it. I was substitute teaching at the time, and I would bring it along into the classrooms and ask, of course, the teacher if it was okay, and of course, they always liked it when I would do that. And the kids would, if they knew I was substitute teaching, the first thing they would say was, did you bring synapse? And not only did I use my children's version of words, which isn't in print yet, but I would also use vocabulary from their subject, and I could think of two off the top of my head. In high school, I remember I used it with a music group and a geography class, I guess, and in grade school, there were a number of ones, including current events. Mm-hmm. And I would just have them look through their current events paper, for example, and they could each pick a word. I remember it was the time of the tsunami, so I remember the tsunami was one of the words.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was amazing how they would really have to learn their vocabulary quickly, because they had to work together to define it by using a sentence. And then I also have given presentations to classrooms using the box game now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess not the presentations, I've played the game.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also given presentations on the inventing process in a couple public school classrooms where they had an inventor's fair.
Sounds like a lot of fun. We have visited your website, synapsethegame.com, and Martin mentioned that they downloaded the iPod game. I have that as well, and just enjoying all the different aspects of it. How did you go about developing an iPod game?
Well, that came as a surprise. That one came to me. There were two college students back in about 2004 or 5, I think it was. Their names were Josh Cromer and Becky Nolte. And I remember one of their very first times of doing something together as a couple was actually coming over to our house and playing the game together. In fact, there's kind of a funny story about that. My nephew and his wife were students, and this was a different time. And I noticed the night that they played Synapse in its beginning form that there was a connection being made between them. I was responsible for their marriage, too. In fact, they will even admit that. But anyway, Josh Cromer and Becky Nolte married each other, and then in 2008, when the boxed game came out, they bought the boxed version of it and took it home to her family's home in Colorado. Her father is Stan Nolte, and he's a computer programmer. And he actually contacted me and asked me what I would think about him doing an app for Apple that could be sold on iTunes. And he kind of interviewed me to make sure I had all the intellectual property so we wouldn't be, going against any patents mm-hmm. or trademarks or anything like that. And I assured him that I had everything. And so then he just went ahead and spent a long time working on that on the side. And he would then send me versions of it, and he would talk me through it on the phone because I'm not that technologically savvy, but he would work with me over the phone so I could get a simulator on my computer, and then I would field test the iPod version at home. Mm-hmm. Plus, our son Dan had an iPod Touch at that time. He field tested it, and Josh Cromer did, and I believe two sons of Stan. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting their names. I wish I could give them credit, too. But they all field tested it. And then it was about a year ago, it was in December of 2009, when Apple accepted it as one of the apps for the iTunes store.
Mm-hmm.
So then the way that works is, for that part of it, we're business partners, and we each take half after Apple takes out its cut.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing about the app is that I can see a future for use in the classroom through a smart board.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody asks me about the smart board for classroom when I demonstrate at teachers' conferences. And that's what I am hoping will be the next step.
Yep.
Stan has the knowledge to be able to convert it. I guess it would that be to Apple? To Windows version, then?
Sure.
I think you two would
right.
know more about that than I would.
Right. Because my wife was asking.
Apple will not allow any of their apps to be protected.
Right.
So it's a real drawback for mm-hmm. the classroom, I think.
Mm-hmm. And my wife was wondering how she could try to engineer the app, you know, into kind of an online or a smart board experience. And the only thing that we talked about was that using a webcam and putting the iPhone, or she has an iPhone, putting the webcam on the iPhone and then manipulating it that way and then letting the webcam project it onto to the screen. But that's not going to be real interactive. So,
right.
But that's a great idea. And I think there's probably untold uses in a classroom setting or even congregation setting that we haven't even thought about yet. So, if people want to learn a little bit more, Carol, what's the website again that they can go to?
It's called synapsethegame.com.
Okay, and the cost
and
of the game right now.
I'm sorry, what?
The cost of the game right now, if they order it.
Right now, online it's $39.95. Although in December, I always run specials before Christmas. I'm not quite sure what it'll be.
Okay, so they can check the website for that.
Right, Right. And also Gail, whom I listened to.
Gail Potratz?
Yes, Gail mm-hmm. Potratz. She emailed me after the podcast that you first mentioned, or you featured Synapse, I guess, about the password and the username. And I went to the site, and I was kind of shocked that it says you need a username and password. Uh-huh. And I just canceled every time I got that. But I just am, I've got to work on that to get that corrected, because that shouldn't be there. And I think that's maybe holding up people from ordering it online.
And how much is the app via iTunes?
That's $4.99.
$4.99, okay. So it can Unless be downloaded.
Unless you can get it, every once in a while, they will run a special. And I had them run a special during teachers' conferences, and then it was 99 cents.
Mm-hmm. So what's in the future? You mentioned maybe a Windows version that could run on a smart board. Any other thoughts? Or you got any other games cooking?
No, I don't really have any other games cooking. But I think, like you said, the possibilities are endless. I have a database of like a Bible version, a junior version, an advanced version. You could get any subject area in school and have different levels, say, of science words or history words.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it would work well in as a team-building activity, either with faculties or in the business setting.
Oh, yeah.
Because you do learn how to work together. The more you play it, the more your team gets the idea of how to build these sentences.
Beautiful.
There you go, Martin. We need to do that in the tech team.
Yeah.
That's right. Tech team building.
Synapsing.
And
there you go.
I have another idea for the future, too. Now, while I was field testing it, we actually kept, at different times, two foreign students. One, Mario, her first language was Spanish, and then Daniela was a German exchange student.
Some ESL stuff.
And they both played it, so I could see it being used as for English language learners.
Yeah.
In fact, Ben and Becky, I mentioned, they are in Russia right now, and they took the game with them. And when they were in the Czech Republic for a year, they were volunteers in Pilsen, teaching in our school there. And Ben was teaching the two Vickers, Greek and Hebrew, I believe. Anyway, they also had English-speaking club, people who had maybe gone to the school before and still wanted to practice their English. And I know they used Synapse a couple times with them as an activity to learn the English language.
Very nice. Carol, thank you so much for your time. And boy, the blessings on your work here. I think this is a neat, it's not just a hobby, I suppose, anymore. It is kind of, kind of defines your life work at this point.
But, I really consider it a hobby.
Okay.
It's not our first focus in our life.
But I'm sure it took a lot of your time to get this to where it's at. But we'll be watching with interest, and I think there'll be some interest across the Senate as more people hear about it. That's probably the most challenging thing, I suppose, is just the promotion side, right?
And I even have a Wells version. I have all kinds of words that are typical Wells words.
Oh, no. All right. Thank you, Carol, for your time. And
thank you so much.
Blessings on your work. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Teamwork at the speed of laughter, she calls it. I think that's a great subtitle, and it's kind of an eye-opening experience for me, just the journey that it takes to get something like this to market, and then hopefully this will take off for her.
And, you know, truly a technology enabled event, because she made those connections via the internet, and 10 years ago we didn't have those kind of connections, so it's a different world we're living in today.
Yep. Yeah. Thanks again, Carol, for spending some time with us, and best of luck with the rollout of your game. Shall we move on to news and tech, Sally?
That's right. We do have some news and tech to share today. First up, we wanted to mention an update on Dropio, DROP.io, which is a file sharing space that we've talked about before on the podcast. Yep. And again, we have some news that it is a Web 2.0 tool that is no longer in existence.
Right.
They updated their blog on October 29th to say that they had been bought by Facebook. And as a result, the Dropio service is going away, and they're going to be discontinuing those things that are uploaded there as of December 15th.
So I wonder if Facebook is going to try and incorporate something like that into their service where you can do some kind of file sharing. We've talked in the past about Facebook using docs.com mm-hmm. and a relationship with Microsoft for document creation. So it seems like they're moving in that direction. But Dropio, as we know it, is dead. And you know, sometimes those companies purchase those other companies for the talent, the human resources, so that they can bring the expertise that they bring in. But we'll see what happens with this. And Facebook had another bit of news last week, and that is the addition of Facebook Places to Android. Now, Facebook Places has been around for a little bit, and that's basically a growing, I don't know exactly what the category is, but location-aware applications, so that you can tag a location with your presence and say, hey, I'm here, and, you know, for whatever reason. And Facebook has that incorporated. There are services like Foursquare and Gowalla that have been doing this. Facebook now does this, and they just rolled out an Android app. And I was playing with it a little bit. It seems to work pretty well. I'm not sure of its future or the whole concept of location-based apps, but we'll see where it goes. And Facebook now has it embedded in their mobile platform at this point.
So just so we're clear, that kind of place or location-based thing is really just for smartphone users. Is that right, Martin?
Yes. I can't say whether it's on
mobile.
Right. I can't say whether there's a kind of a component in the regular Facebook page. I'm not sure how that would work. But no, it's GPS related. So if you're at the local Starbucks, you can check in, so to speak, via your iPhone or your Android phone or whatever. You have to be with a device that's both either Wi-Fi and or GPS enabled. I think some locations, and this is, I don't know if Facebook is doing this yet, but I know with like Foursquare, is that if you check in at a certain time or a certain number of times, you know, they're offering free coupons for discounts on coffee or those kinds of things. So maybe there is a, marketing approach to this.
Okay, that's interesting.
Let's move on to picks of the week.
Well, this week I found something new to share called openclipart.org. I don't believe we've talked about this one before, but
so.
It was a nice find for me to find a place that has just free and public domain clip art that people share. There are over 35,000 images, and I really was thinking church calendars and bulletin newsletter kind of things when I found this website. They are available in SVG, which is scalable vector graphic format, so you can get a really large version of the graphics that you can download to some hefty image editors, or you can also get PNG, which is a pretty common format as well. So I did some searching. I found Thanksgiving-themed images. I found many images tagged with religion, you know, all different kinds of religion represented there, but just another source for you to kind of file away in your tool belt and make use of if you're looking for a particular clip art kind of image.
Very good. Openclipart.org. Good timing, because I think a lot of congregations and schools are looking for clip art that they can put in their newsletters that are festival based, Thanksgiving, Christmas, those kinds of things. So, very good. My pick of the week is a rerun. I did a little bit of research when I know that I had offered this as a pick before, but it's way back in 08. So I think it's time to repick, if that's possible. It's not a regift; it's a repick, and that's Zobni, X-O-B-N-I. It is for Outlook users. It is a plug-in or an add-on to Outlook that essentially sits in the, you know, the right hand, you know, side of your screen and gives you all kinds of information about your email activity. And there is a plus version, but the free version seems to work pretty well for me. And they've added a few things, so that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up again. That they're up to a version 1.9. And, you know, as I look at my Outlook, I have this little column in the right, and it basically gives you all kinds of information about the sender. So whoever sent you an email, you can build a profile on. So it'll actually give you all the information they can find out about this particular user. So, for instance, I can see all of the conversations I've had with a particular user. It scans your Outlook in your PST files and groups all the conversations together, so I can see conversations I've had over time. I can see all the files that I've exchanged with this person over time and actually open up those files, you know, if they were attached, of course. I can see any upcoming appointments that I have with that particular person if they're on my calendar and they're invited to a particular meeting. It also shows all kinds of, and this is fairly new to the application, all kinds of social networking information. So if they're in LinkedIn or Facebook or Twitter, it'll give you that information. It'll show a picture. So it'll pull if they have a Facebook picture, a profile picture, or a Twitter picture, or a LinkedIn picture. So that'll come up right next to their name. So if it's somebody that maybe you don't know even that's sending you an email, and they have a Facebook profile or something like that that it can find based on email address, it'll pop that right up. So it gives you a little bit more dimension to your email communications. And it's really a lifesaver for me because I have a notoriously terrible memory, and this helps me go back in time to review all of the conversations I've had with a person and also the files that I've exchanged. So, great tool.
I have a notoriously terrible ability to organize my emails, so it probably would help me too. I usually can remember that I got something, but finding it is more of a challenge.
Uh-huh.
So tying it all together sounds like a nice treat.
Oh, yeah. Very nice. So that's Xobni, XOBNI.com.
Very good.
All
well,
right.
Well, Martin, you are getting ready to make a trip up to, is it Manitowoc this weekend?
I am.
Where you can stream the Wells Regional Choral Fest for us.
Right. And that's this Friday at 7 o'clock Central Time, and on Sunday again at 2 o'clock Central Time. The Friday concert is a pops concert, so a lot of song and dance routines. And Sunday is a sacred concert, and that'll be up in Manitowoc. I'll be up there doing the streaming. And if you go to wells.net/ what is it? Streams/live. That is the place to go to find out or to view the stream, and they are very popular. So I think it'll be well worth your time to go. And they will not be archived for copyright reasons, but we can make them available via the live stream. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, tune in for a great concert. I'm sure it'll be very good.
Yep.
All right.
Community feedback, Sally.
We heard again this week from Debbie Spriggs, your wife, who's being a busy teacher these days and learning lots of things for use in the classroom. This week she pointed us to PowerPoint in the Classroom, which is a series of tutorials, online tutorials about using PowerPoint in the classroom. So it takes you through creating slides, making changes, adding images and charts, adding sound, doing some timing and rehearsing with your PowerPoint. Looks like a really great way to get introduced to all the features of PowerPoint and mm-hmm. making use of it specifically in the classroom setting.
Yeah, very logical, step-by-step through the use of this in the classroom. It's kind of a beginner's guide, which is fine, and I think people probably should start with that, those that are certainly new to PowerPoint or using it in the classroom, and gives you some real good tips. So thank you, Debbie.
Next, we heard from Pastor Aaron Fry. Pastor Fry is our resident Logos expert, Logos software for Bible study. And we actually have a page on our Wells Tech Wiki dedicated to Bible software where we have all kinds of links, resources, reviews, user groups, and a pretty extensive list of podcast that we've done on the topic as well. And Pastor Fry actually edited that page recently and added a new link. And it's kind of a comparison of the different Bible software, different popular Bible software solutions that are available. And it's actually done by one of the Logos scholars. He calls him Michael Heiser. So a new link, it's called Bible Software Shootout. And if you're looking to review the different available Bible softwares, you might want to check out this new article that Pastor Fry posted for us.
Very good. Thanks, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Next up, we heard from Tim Pullman, who's a member of Mountain View in Calgary, Alberta. And just a quick mention that he is writing on behalf of their whole, I don't know if you'd call it a district or the Wells Canada group of congregations.
Right.
They're looking to do some online learning. And we were able to point him to various online learning resources. You know, obviously the seminary, MLC, and even us as a synod have kind of standardized on using Moodle as a online learning platform, and you can actually go to MLC and take online classes about how to teach in Moodle. But in addition, there are new Web 2.0 tools out. Schoology and Edmodo are two of them that I pointed them to, where you can develop your own online platform there within those educational software packages. So lots of opportunity there for creating online learning, and we're looking forward to hearing what they do with it up in Canada.
Very good. Thank you, Tim, for sharing.
And then lastly, we heard from Jason Schmidt, our tweeting teacher from Gethsemane in Omaha, Nebraska, and he shared a link to MailView, which is used for creating video email. It's mailvu.com, and you can go there and just activate your webcam and microphone and create a quick video and then send it via email really simply. So looks like a neat tool for enhancing communication.
Yep. There are these services work pretty similarly, where you essentially work through a web interface, upload the video, and it basically stores it and then sends either an embedded link or a link for somebody to open and view it. So it just gives a little bit more of a flavor to an email and kind of a personal touch. So it might not be bad for greeting cards and those kinds of things. If you're sending a birthday wish, that'd be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
All flash-based.
Some Christmas cards this year. So.
Yeah, absolutely. A singing Christmas card from the Draper family.
The Von Trapp singers here in Sleepy Eye.
That's right. All right, let's move on to what's coming up for next week, and it is Office Administrators Week. We have been running a series now once a month, and this is month three, right? Are we into the third week or second or third month?
So.
Yep. Where we talk about all things related to the church or school office and those people who work within them. And we're going to be talking specifically, easy for me to say, about church newsletter creation. And we've got an interview coming up as well, and I'm looking forward to that. That's been a fun series.
Yeah, and I think that's a very popular topic, and so we want to delve in and find out what people are using and share some ideas for desktop publishing specifically.
Yeah, well, we can talk about things like MailChimp and how to send that stuff out and how to get people actively involved in wanting to receive electronic newsletters. So it's all kinds of stuff we can talk about this topic. So very good. Let's close the show, Sally, with the music of Koine, Built on the Rock, from their album Koine 2. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Built on the rock, the church shall stand, even when steeples are falling. Crumbled half spires in every land, bells still are chiming and calling. Calling the young and old to rest, but above all the soul distressed, longing for rest everlasting. temples made with hands, God the Most High is not dwelling. High above earth, His temple stands, all earthly temples excelling. Yet He who dwells in heaven above chooses to live with us in love, making our bodies His temple. God's house of living stones, built for His own habitation. He through baptismal grace has owned, heirs of His wondrous salvation. Were we but to His name to tell, yet He would deign with us to dwell, with all His grace and His favor. Just do.